Amen. Yeah, I second that, what Joel has been saying about the small groups. We're basically just doing sermon-based groups. We're going a little deeper about what we're talking about on Sunday. And boy, I tell you, this first chapter of Colossians is so thick. It's so deep. You'll barely scratch the surface this morning for certain, and you'll barely go beyond that, being able to take some time to discuss it deeper in your groups. So I even encourage you on your own to look into these things and read them. We kind of talked about last week how Paul wrote this letter just to really communicate how sufficient Jesus really is. That when we take Jesus and we try and add something to Jesus, Jesus plus something, that's how new religions are formed. And Paul is coming against heresies in his day where they were looking to add things to Jesus and ultimately starting. New religions were already starting to crop up, or diversions of Christianity were already starting to crop up by the time Paul had written this. And he's just trying to get them to understand that Jesus is all you need. It's all sufficient within Jesus. And what he does here is, as he moves further on, we looked at the first 14 verses last week. Now we're going to look at verses 15 to 23 this morning. And what Paul does here is, a lot of commentators agree that what Paul lists in these verses is probably one of the most lofty and penetrating views of who Jesus is in the smallest amount. It's like the most compact amount of sentence, where he puts so much stuff in there, just really telling you in a matter of like six verses, he lists 14 glorious traits of Jesus in just six verses. John Piper puts it like this. He says, in this section, Paul gives a litany of amazing truths about Jesus Christ that are probably the most concentrated description of the glories of Jesus in the entire New Testament. That's saying a lot. He's saying what Paul says here is probably one of the most concentrated descriptions of the glories of Jesus that you're going to find in all of the New Testament. So let's just take a look at it. I think the first thing that would be good to do is just read it. And you're going to see how thick this is, how much is contained in here. Starting verse 15, chapter 1, Paul wrote, "He is the image, Jesus is, the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For by him all things were created, both in the heavens and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities. All things have been created through him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. He is also head of the body, the church, and he is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, so that he himself will come to have first place in everything. For it was the Father's good pleasure for all the fullness to dwell in him and through him to reconcile all things to himself, having made peace through the blood of his cross through him," I say, whether things on earth or things in heaven. Man. And he goes on, "And although you were formerly alienated and hostile in mind, engaged in evil deeds, yet he has now reconciled you in his fleshly body through death, in order to present you before him holy, blameless, and beyond reproach, if indeed you continue in the faith firmly established and steadfast and not moved away from the hope of the gospel that you have heard, which was proclaimed in all creation under heaven, of which I, Paul, was made a minister." Man, what a mouthful. He just packs it all in there. All these points, all these attributes of Jesus. And I kind of listed them out just so you could really get the full impact of what he's doing here. I took a couple screens to do it, but here's the first seven. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. I want to just stop there for a second, a little bit of a sidebar there,
is that word of can be a little bit nebulous, because cults have actually started. They added things to Jesus based on that verse. Well, wait a minute. Firstborn of all creation. So does that mean that Jesus is part, and there's that little word, of creation? Just like this pulpit is made of wood. It came from wood. Is that what that means? Because of can be used in different ways. You could also say that not only did Jesus, was he of creation, did he come from creation, but you could use that little word of and say the president is the commander-in-chief of the armed forces. What does that mean? That means that he is in charge of the armed forces. So in that case, the word of means something different. That obviously is what Paul is saying here. He's in charge of creation. He's over. The NIV outright gives you that word. It doesn't use the word of. The New American Standard and the King James uses the word of. NIV just outright told you it means over. He's over creation. He has authority over the whole thing. And then we see, well, firstborn, what about that? Does that mean chronologically he was the first one born and he was came from creation? Well, first of all, we know he's over creation. Firstborn was really a terminology in first century during Paul's time. The firstborn used to get everything. It used to get all the wealth, all the status, all the standing of the father would go to the firstborn son. And then he would see to it, if he was a good son, that it got distributed properly and everybody was taken care of. But the point being is that the firstborn had all the rights, the power, and the status of the father. Paul is saying Jesus Christ has all the rights, all the authority of the father, and he is over all creation, the whole thing. So he's saying, there it is, he has all authority and dignity of the father, and he's over all creation. By him, all things were created. Obviously, if he came from creation and was firstborn, then how could everything have been created by him? He was created. No, he wasn't. He was over creation. Number four, through him all things were created, and for him all things were created. There you have it. By him, through him, and for him all things were created. For him. You ever look at something in nature, and you're like, sometimes you go to an aquarium, there's some weird stuff, right? That is the ugliest fish I have ever seen. Well, God says it wasn't made for you. I made that for me. Everything was made for my glory. We often say that about worship. Oh, geez, he's not going to do that song. I don't like that song. Song's not for you. All right, we're not doing the song for you. It's for God. For him, all things were created. He is before all things. He has no beginning and no end. Try and figure that one out. In him, all things hold together. I love that one. That's wild. All things are being held together by him. That there's so many things to fathom on that. You know, that is actually one of the biggest stumbling blocks for agnostics and atheists. Two of the biggest ones that are proponents for a lot of higher education, because they were brilliant guys, is David Hume and Bertrand Russell. Hume was an agnostic, Russell was an atheist, but they were brilliant. You know, I always say, all truths, God truth. Actually, Joel said that, and then he heard it from somebody else. Having heard it from somebody else, there's nothing new under the sun. But anyway, all truth is God's truth. In other words, if Satan says to you, 2 + 2 = 4, guess what? It's still true. These guys are smart. They give you a lot of insights, but they come to wrong conclusions often. At least I think he did. I don't think atheism is really the right belief to have. It is a belief, though. You believe that there is no God. You believe in atheism. I believe in theologyism. But he says, and Hume and Russell said, you know what? We will say this, that there's a problem here because we've looked at all this stuff, but there's an order to the universe that they can't explain. Why is it ordered? You know, all these things. Why does the earth spin at 1,000 miles per hour if it only spun at 100 or 10 Yeah, well, say 100 miles an hour, then the days would be twice as long and everything would burn up. The nights would be 10 times as long, rather, and the days would be 10 times as long. So therefore, everything burns up or everything freezes. Or if the moon's closer, we could have tides that would actually cover the highest mountains. And the list goes on, and they're like, why is there all this order? And their conclusion is, listen, they can't just chuck their theory. So what they say is, there's no way the orderliness of the universe proves that there's a God, that God exists. But we do have to say this. We have to say it's inexplicable, and so therefore you certainly can't disprove God either. I can't prove God through this stuff, but I'll tell you what, man, I can't disprove that he exists because of all this order. It's just too much. See, it's a problem for them. The order of the universe is a problem for them, but Paul says, it's not a problem for me. I know who holds it all together. It's not a problem for Christians. Maybe a problem for others, but we know it's in him that all things hold together. Okay, let's finish the list here. That's 1-7. Then he says, he is the head of the body, the church. See, the pastoral side of Paul is coming out. First 7 points, he says he's the king of the cosmos. Now he's saying he's also the king of you personally. He's also the head of the church. Who's the church? Ain't this building. It's you. It's me. He's also the head of the church, the body. He's the beginning, the firstborn from the dead. He will come to have first place in everything. All the fullness of God dwells in him. He reconciles all things to himself. He makes peace by the blood of the cross. It's all in Jesus. Jesus is sufficient. I mean, all of that, you really think you need to add anything to it? I mean, this even makes more clear the point I was trying to make last week. How isn't Jesus enough? I mean, to say that Jesus isn't enough and, you know, well, I'm so glad I have Jesus. I'm so glad I have a relationship with him and I thank God for Jesus. And if I could just now, if I have Jesus, if I could have that and just this other thing, then I'd be okay. Is like saying, here, have Bill Gates' net worth of $80 billion. So you have the $80 billion and you're like, oh, this is great. You know what? I'm so thankful I have this $80 billion. And if I have this $80 billion and this microphone, then I'll be all right. I mean, come on. He's trying to say, don't you think this is sufficient enough? Look at all that he has, all that he is. He just makes it so clear. Peter agreed with him. I think I mentioned this verse last week. 2 Peter 1:3 says, his divine power has given us everything we need. Everything we need for life and godliness through our knowledge of him who called us by his own glory and goodness. It's amazing lists that he gives here. Again, 14 glorious traits of Jesus in just 6 verses. Now, I know usually pastors in a sermon only have three, you know, it's common we have like a 3-point sermon, right? Well, I got 14 of them this morning, all right? So I hope you packed a lunch. We're going to be here a little while. Okay, not really. Actually, you'll be relieved to know, as I kind of thought about this a little bit, that first of all, there's no way we're going to cover these this morning. There's no way you're going to cover them in your small groups. In fact, I think we'll be worshiping and marveling about these truths throughout eternity. We'll just begin to understand the depth of them. But here's what I want to do this morning. I want to look at the first trait here. So we're going to just focus on that so you don't have to worry if you didn't pack a lunch. Not going to be that long. We're going to look at the first one, and you can hopefully discuss the rest in your small groups. Here's why I want to primarily look at the first trait that he lists there, besides not wanting to keep you here too long. If you warp the first trait, then you're going to warp traits 2-14. I think if we alter or bend the first trait that he lists there, we're going to end up altering and bending the other traits that follow. If we don't start the list off right, we're not going to finish the list right. So that's what I want to look at. So let's just narrow it down to that first point, that first trait that he gives us, just by itself. Here it is. He, which is Jesus, is the image of the invisible God. He is the image of the invisible God. That's such an imperative, I think, and crucial point. In fact, it's so imperative that God dedicated an entire one of the Ten Commandments to it. In fact, it's number 2 of the top 10. God dedicated one of the Ten Commandments so that we would understand that we wouldn't undermine this point right here that Paul's making, that Jesus is the image of the invisible God. If we don't get that, it will wreak havoc in our lives. Here's what that second commandment says. You shall not make to yourself a graven image of anything in the heavens above or on the earth beneath or in the water below. You shall not bow down to them, says the Lord. In other words, God says it's absolutely forbidden for you to try and make me, who is an invisible God, into something that is visible. It's absolutely forbidden for us to create an image on our own of what we want him to be, because God has made himself visible himself. He's done it. Knowing that we need an image, and he's given us an image in Jesus. We want to come up with our own images, but we don't need to. God's already given us one. I love how Tim Keller puts this. Look at this. He says it this way. The reason we can't make our own images is because God has provided the right image that will not distort our lives. Jesus is the image. See, what I'm saying is, we end up coming up with our own images of things that we want to be the way we want them to be, even in relationships. One of the problems is that we want a person to be a certain way, and instead of listening to them or really observing who they are, we kind of create an image in our own mind of who we really want them to be. Sometimes it's almost like a denial. I can remember when I was in youth ministry 20 years ago, and it kind of helped me to hopefully maybe be a little more realistic about my own kids, because I would see how parents would want so much to believe certain things about their kids that they would end up building up a false image of who they really were. I can remember a mom just talking to me about her son who was in my youth group at the time and telling me, you know, oh, I'm so glad he's this and he's not that and he's not doing what all the other kids are doing. And I'm thinking to myself, should I or shouldn't I? Should I tell her that I just busted her son after the last youth group smoking weed behind the church? You know, on the other hand, I can't really blame her son. I mean, you have to suffer through a whole youth group with me as the pastor. You probably want to get stoned too, you know? But be it as it may, see, we put in our mind the image that we want, you know, of what we want to think of. She was imposing her wishes and her needs and deciding what her son really was like, and it injected distortions into the relationship. We often relate to the person as I imagine the person to be, not as the person reveals himself or herself to be. I mean, lots of times it happens in marriage, right? We have a certain image of the person, and then we find out 5-10 years later what the image really is. You realize you married a mental image, maybe, of your spouse, and now you're starting to really get to understand and know the real person. We manipulate our world, and we imagine it to be, even our environment, often, so that it could be what we want it to be, instead of dealing with what's really happening. Here's the point on this. If it's destructive in relationships, when we don't really see things as they really are, when we allow our image of certain things to be distorted, how much more dangerous is it when we do it with God? When we allow our image of who the real God is to become distorted, we make him into what we would like him to be rather than what the Bible tells us he is, as Paul tells us right here who he is. And he sums up the whole thing here in Colossians 1:15. How do we keep ourselves at least conscious from drifting into making graven images? A graven image is a human made-up image of God. Where have you kind of custom made God so he can fit the way that you want him to look? Instead of looking at the image of the real God, who is Jesus. He's given us the image. Why are we making up our own? The record's right here. There are two parts kind of to this idea anyway. And what the Bible says about the issue. And I saw somewhere where it was kind of put in two parts. I wanted to put that up here. It's forbidden for us to ever try to make the invisible God visible because God has made himself visible in Jesus. It's forbidden because any physical picture, now this is just one sidebar of it, but think of this. Any physical picture that you would use to represent God will always conceal more than it will reveal. I mean, let's face it, you know, we got it covered right now, but, you know, it you could have a picture of Jesus and then what is he going to be? Is he going to be smiling or frowning? Okay, now if he's smiling, that means, okay, we understand the attributes of his grace and his love. But what about the other side of his attributes that we see in Revelation, that he comes against unrighteousness and evil? What about the side of Jesus that comes in and just like cracks a whip and tells them, listen, man, why have you made my house that's supposed to be a house of prayer into a den of thieves? Anytime you try and depict who he is, will always conceal more than it will reveal. There's problems. There's limitations to pictures. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not radical on this stuff. I don't say that we should never make pictures. I think that's not really the point of the Bible, that we're not allowed to draw any of this stuff. But I think what the Bible is saying, don't bow down to it. Don't allow it to skew your image because God's given us the image. This one guy, he died back in the early 90s. I've read some of his stuff. It just fascinating. His name was Tom Skinner. He was an evangelist that had grown up in Harlem. And he was an activist in a lot of ways. A lot of people didn't know about him because he was only 52 when he passed away. And he said, one of the things that he said is, the reason I didn't become a Christian when I was a teenager was because of the pictures that they had in our church up on the stained glass or whatever it was. And the pictures that I used to see in Sunday school, I think in a way that hindered me from really coming to know Jesus. He said, I looked at those pictures and I said, man, that guy wouldn't last an hour in this neighborhood. You know, it just kind of skews the way we really see him. And we get the wrong impression. We don't really see him as he's supposed to be, as who he really is. Because you see, if you depict Jesus, like we said, there's the meek, mild approach, the melt-in-your-mouth, sweet Jesus that's holding the lamb like we have here, you know. You're not going to be able to depict the wrath and the fury and the courage that he had when he came in the temple and cleaned house. That's the problem with creating physical representations. But that's not the main point. It goes so much deeper than that. The word imagine comes from imagination. All right? Imagine, did you ever notice that? It's part of that word. When we think of an image, we're thinking always of a physical image, but physical images are based on mental images. See, we think graven images are just things that you make. Okay, here's the golden calf. We have to be careful because the real ones that do destruction are the ones that we come up in our mental images. Who's Jesus in your mental images? Are you prone? Are you vulnerable to graven images in your mind?
J.I. Packer, this guy's still alive. He's 88 years old. He's one of those old wise theologians, British guy, British Columbia. I put J.A., it's actually J.I., but he says this, "You must not imagine God to be whatever you want him to be." Image, imagine. "But rather, you must let your imagination be regulated by the truth." Paul says, here's the real image. Here's the word. I know there's certain things, certain points, certain adjustments you'd like to make to the image of Jesus that fits your lifestyle, that fits what you want to do, but Packer here says, let's be careful. You must let your imagination be regulated to the truth. Are you trying to squeeze the truth to your imagination, or are you allowing your imagination to be fit to the truth? Paul gives us the truth, which we regulate our image of God. It's found in Jesus. And basically, don't worship him as you want him to be. Don't worship him as you think of him as you want him to be. Worship him and think of him as Scripture reveals him to be. And Paul just does this masterful job and lists 14 of these incredible, glorious traits of Jesus. Listen, imagination can be negative. It's corrupted by sin, but it also can be a great asset for us when it's filled with truth. When we feed our imagination with truth, a good question to ask yourself is, will the truth, again, I said it before, I'm going to just say it now, will the truth regulate my imagination, or will my imagination shape the truth? You know, you can't really allow your imagination to be shaped by the truth unless you get into this thing. That you begin to understand what it's telling us, what the real image looks like of the invisible God. Read the Gospels, man. Just read the red letters. Let it sink into your mind. Let it burn into your consciousness. Our imagination is easily corrupted. It is. There's so many ways that we can imagine things how we really want them to be when they're not really that way. You know, I mean, you think you did good eating all week, but do you really want the truth now? Well, there's a scale. You know, I'm not going to go on a scale this week. Rather keep it. I remember I started leasing cars about 3 years ago. But before that, man, I wasn't as good as Joel, but man, I'd try and get some serious mileage out of those things. I had a Ford Windstar, had that sucker up to 200,000 miles. I had started to imagine that I was going to get 500,000 miles out of this thing. I imagined myself being on a commercial for Ford, you know, they were going to use my car. Got 500,000 miles, they'd give me a new one for letting me use the van, you know. I was sure, but the only thing is that I have this element of truth check that is with me. It's called Tina. You know, a Jewish truth check. So we'd be driving, you know, and I'm driving along in this thing, and every once in a while she'd be like, "What's that noise?" I'm like, "I don't hear any noise. I mean, every car that has 200,000 miles makes that noise. You know, what are you talking about? I don't hear anything. Come on." And then maybe it's like June, right? You haven't had the air conditioner on all winter. So you put it on and only warm air comes out. You know, she's like, "Oh, this thing must be broken. It's either going to have to be replaced or recharged. I don't feel any cool air coming out of here. Just give it time. Give it time. It's going to come on." You know, you got to have like 3 hours later, it's still blowing warm air, you know. "No, it's going to come on. I imagine, I'm, because I don't want to have to admit it. Listen, if I face the reality of the truth of this thing, I'm going to have to pay money. I'm going to have to bring it in to be repaired. I might have to go without it." I mean, I just hate the whole thing, don't you? So it's like, rather than face the reality of what's really going on, I'd rather just imagine the whole thing. But sooner or later, man, you can only imagine so long, you're going to run up against reality. And, you know, the car example's a little funny, but there's a lot more serious things that we do with this stuff, gang. How many times have you heard people say, "Well, I just don't think I could believe in a God that sends anybody to hell"?
Well, I just don't think I could believe in a God who allows so much suffering. I definitely can't believe in a God who says you shouldn't have sex unless you get married. I mean, come on. I just can't believe in a God who says I always have to be honest in every single situation. I just can't believe in it, and so on and so on. Listen, there may be 30 things that God says through the Bible about himself that grate against your spirit. And actually, a century ago, or in some other culture, there's probably 30 other things that grated against their spirit and bothered them about how God says through the Bible what the truth really is. And it grates against our spirit, so we want to reimagine him to be something that fits more with our image rather than the image that's here in the Bible. And God calls that a graven image. Paul says you need to come back here and look at the image of the invisible God, who he really is. We want to think of him as the God we want him to be. Because our imagination is fallen. Paul says, here's the real Jesus. The image of the invisible God. Here he is. He's awesome. He's absolutely equal with the Father. In dignity and honor and power with the Father. And you see all that great stuff out there? You see the forest, you see that ocean, you see the sky? He made it all. It's by him, through him, and for him. It's all for him. He's God, and he holds it all together. He's God, and you know what? It's the God of the Bible. He's not safe. He's not tame. You can't keep him on a leash. You can't put him in a box. You're not going to be able to put him in your pocket. You can imagine, if you imagine him to be anything other than the God that he's revealed in here to be, you're going to be on a collision course with reality sooner or later. Martin Luther said it this way, 500 some years ago. People want to say, I like to think of God this way. I believe that what I'm doing will glorify God. But God will not have you tell him how he would be served. He tells you in his word how he must be served. When you read Paul's list here, you get this incredible list that describes a being that is really beyond the scope and magnitude of your imagination. So we want to have an image that we can manage. It's not too terrifying or unrelatable. One that fits what I want, yet God says, don't make any graven images. Look at the only image that I've given you that represents the invisible God. That's the solution. God gives us the image, Jesus Christ, image of the invisible God. Otherwise, all we have are these lofty descriptions of God. Do you ever think about that? I think it would have been so much harder for me to really feel intimate and passionate towards God before Jesus Christ came. Because all you have are abstract theologies. And then God came in the person of Jesus Christ. You know what? There's a person. I can see how he acted, how he loved other people, how he didn't condemn other people. And it's an actual personage of God that I can relate to now. I can have a relationship. Man, abstract theologies, it's like tough, but he's given us the image of Jesus Christ. I can relate having a relationship with God. It makes it personal. I think that's why the pastor side of Paul comes out and he moves in from Jesus, who is the king of the cosmos, to the Jesus who is the personal God who would like you to be, who needs you to be, to let him be your personal king in your personal life. Not only is he the image of the invisible God, the one of all creation, but Paul goes to that place and he says, you know what? He's king of the whole cosmos, but add this, he says. He is also, there it is, one more time, head of the body, the church, you, made peace through the blood of the cross. He has reconciled you and me in order to present you. Remember we talked about this last week? I mean, could you imagine being presented before God, holy, blameless, and beyond reproach? NIV says beyond accusation. Really? That's the deal. If indeed you continue in the faith, firmly established and steadfast and not moved away from the hope of the gospel. Wait a minute, I thought it wasn't been works. I thought it was all the grace of God. He says, if you indeed continue in the faith, he'll present you holy. What does that mean? Well, the works don't make you saved, but they show that you are. When Jesus had all, I've said this many times, let me just say it one more time. All the nations are spread out before Jesus. What does he do? He says, okay, let's see who gave their heart to the Lord. Let me see. Oh, I see that hand. Is there another? Okay. He didn't do that. He says, you know a tree by its fruit. Did you really experience the salvation of Jesus Christ? I'll tell you how we find out. I was naked and you clothed me. I was lonely and you visited me. And as much as you've done these things, you've done it unto the least of these, you've done it unto me. If you indeed continue in the faith, doesn't save you, but man, if there's no smoke, there's no fire, okay? If he says it's an apple tree and there's oranges, guess what? It ain't no apple tree, gang. It's not rocket science. You look at the life. If they continue, take this section of scripture we're looking at this week. I'm telling you, I'm going to just tell you, last week for me was so great just looking at the prayer of Paul, you know, because, you know, again, being a people pleaser, I want to do what this one's will is for me is, and that one's will, and your will, and that one, and then sometimes I have my own will, and Paul says, listen, here's the prayer, just pray this, that God would saturate you with the knowledge of his will. Let him saturate you with the knowledge of his will, that you'd be filled with spiritual wisdom and the things that he wants you to do that you could not walk, then you'll be able to walk in a manner worthy of the Lord. That just really shot through me. I memorized that part. I started praying it. Then I get to this thing and I'm like, you know what? You need to memorize this too. I mean, 14 glorious traits. You're feeling complacent. You're feeling dead. I tell you what, boy, you start just rattling off these traits of who Jesus is, the visible of the invisible God, the visible image and representation. It's going to start coming into, just allow it to burn into our minds. Memorize it. Let it fill our mind of the invisible God. And then I said, like I said before, just start reading the Gospels, understanding the image of God, who Jesus is. Find the places in your life where there's stress and pressure. And I want to just end with this. How does this all practically work out? How does this graven image work in my life? Well, let me just tell you this. I want you to look at the parts in your life where you're full of stress. You're full of anxiety. You're full of worry. Underneath it, you're going to find a distorted view of Jesus. You're going to find that you have a distorted view of God, and that's what's causing it. There is always a false image underneath your problem. What do you mean, Greg? Your impatience in your life is because you don't see the patience of God. Your bitterness comes because you don't see the grace of God. Well, what do you mean? Well, you worry because you don't see the wisdom of God. What do you mean? Well, you're worried. Why? Well, you know, these circumstances are not the circumstances that I wanted. Well, do you think God's out of control? Did they take him by surprise? Oh, geez, I didn't mean that to happen to Greg. How'd that happen? He knows exactly what's happening. He's got wisdom. I didn't want these circumstances, but I guess God did, but I don't want them, and I'm not so sure he did, and so what do? I worry. I'm not really believing in God's wisdom. I worry because I don't see the wisdom of God. I lack self-control because I don't really believe the goodness of God. You realize that? We don't really trust that he's got our best intentions in mind, so we don't really believe in the goodness of God totally when we really think about it. You know, like I said before, you know, what do you mean no sex until I get married? What do you think, I'm some low testosterone hormone deprived guru or something? I mean, come on. You mean you don't really believe that God knew what he was saying when he told you that? What image are you looking at? God will never tell you to do anything that isn't best for you, that isn't good for you. We lack self-control because we don't believe in the goodness of God. We rip ourselves off in so many areas. I think Jesus wants to just say this to us this morning.
If you stop trying to make me into your likeness, I'll be able to make you into my likeness. If you'll only let me stretch your imagination and stop confining me to your imagination, then you know what? I'm going to be able to make you into something beyond your imagination. I think that's what he wants to say to us. Get him out of your pocket. Get him out of our box. Get him off the leash. Look at the real image. Let it burn in your heart. Let it burn in your mind. Let's pray.